Coming up on this week's show, Apple officially kills the iPod.
Portal comes to the Nintendo 64.
And we chat to the co-founder of Revolution Software, Tony Warriner.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one book you should definitely check out from them, The Secret History of Mac Gaming, the new expanded edition with 70 extra pages, 60 new images, and a fascinating reminder of the important role the Mac played in the history of video gaming. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming books at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 327, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And welcome to our favourite part of the week where we get to completely nerd out for the next hour-ish, all about our favourite subject, retro video games, of course. And we'll be bringing you up to speed on all the big headlines in the world of retro gaming from the last week. And of course, bringing you a veteran of the industry. We have a guest on every single episode. So we'll tell you more about our incredible guest in just a minute. Nice of you to take yourself away from your Amiga DJing for an hour as well, Ravi, to hop on. I know you've got a pretty busy weekend ahead.
I'm prepping because I'm going to be doing a battle. So this might be the first Amiga DJ battle in history. But it's at the Southwest Amiga Group, and this is a pretty cool event, Workbench 2022. It'd been delayed before because of COVID, but this event's quite big. You know, you get about 100 people there, and people are all meeting up. They're showing different projects. You know, the guys from Retro Games Limited are there, and they're going to be showing their A500 Mini and doing like a presentation on it as well. So there'll probably be more info and like a kind of show and tell there. And I'm going to be DJing Hoffman, who is the actual creator of the DJ software that we're using, so I think he's going to kick my ass. I've been preparing tunes and I'm nervous, and it's going to be live streamed as well, so we'll put a link in the show notes so you folks can check that out.
How do you decide who wins the battle then? Is it because I don't
audience
normally
decides, like it? I think so.
Right, okay.
I think it's going to be like we have a little section each, and we play our tunes, and then the audience kind of votes on it. And I don't know if we get a prize. I want a prize, but even a chocolate bar would be good.
The pride is the prize.
The pride, yeah.
So not that you're using your massive audience on this podcast every week to your advantage and telling every Retro Hour listener to come online and vote for you.
If it was a virtual one, we could spam it, couldn't we? But you have to be there in person, yeah.
So you're doing that this coming weekend on Sunday, yeah?
On Saturday night. Tomorrow, yeah.
If you listen to the show when it comes out on Friday, we'll link that up on our socials and I'll stick it in the show notes as well. You've been actually out and about again this week. Went to the Birmingham gaming market for the first time.
Yeah, I did. It's not the first time, the second time I've been to
right.
It might have even been the third time. But yeah, it's the second one since COVID, since lockdown and everything like that. Second one in Birmingham. But yeah, that was really fun. I need to stop spending so much money. But it is really cool. I go with my friend Jason, and like it keeps happening. Like, oh, you Joe from the Retro Hour. Like every, you know, I say keeps happening, but it keeps happening when I'm with Jay, and it's really nice. I'm always like, oh yeah, yeah, I'm kind of thing. Like, you know, nice to meet you, etc. This particular person didn't tell me their name, unfortunately, but he's just like, are you paying these people? Like, it's crazy, but it's just like, look, it's like minded people. We're at a game. We're at a retro games event.
Were they in a Brummy accent though? Are you Joe from the Retro Hour?
No, they wasn't. But no, it was really, really fun. It's just great getting out, you know, and just seeing people and talking to people and saying, you know, even people who aren't fans of the show and stuff, but just seeing familiar faces, you know, talking to the vendors who are always there and stuff. So it was really, really cool to get out. But it was missing battling Amiga DJs, I must admit. That would have been really cool.
Everything needs battling Amiga DJs
to make it better.
So yeah, very busy summer ahead. Lots of stuff going on. Of course, we'll keep you up to date with where we're going to be over the coming months as well. Let's get into this week's show, though, because we've actually got an incredible guest interview that me and Ravi did last night, actually, with Tony Warriner. Now, he was the co-founder of Revolution Software. And, you know, I mean, we've done episodes about, you know, Beneath a Steel Sky, a couple of episodes about that, but I mean, God, Beneath a Steel Sky, you know me, I'm a huge point-and-click adventure game fan, and I'd rate that game up there in my top five of all time. Just an incredible game.
Well, they were a great adventure software company, and kind of Laura the Temptress was a huge one, and then Beneath a Steel Sky, and then it went into Broken Sword later on. And it was a really kind of unique period where they were changing from, you know, floppy disk format, and they were getting into CDs. So there was stuff like voice acting that was getting added. But also, like, Tony's got a really big history with Charles Cecil, who we've previously had on the podcast, who was the other founder of Revolution. And, you know, there's just some fantastic stories about, like, programming in the early days, the relationships between companies as well, and, you know, Telecom Soft and stuff, the Darling Brothers, and there's just a lot of history and connections in this interview, and it's a really interesting one.
And I think, like you said, we've had Charles on the show, but it's always nice to kind of get the other side of the story, because that's the thing we say. I mean, we often get people who've maybe worked for the same company at similar times, but you generally find that you get a completely other side of the story, and it's a much more rounded picture, isn't it, getting someone else from the same company?
Yeah, and it's nice, and it's kind of like, how did you guys meet, and then how did you develop together and work and end up kind of building into this great company? And he's actually got this book coming up, From 8-Bits to Revolution, and we're going to talk a bit about that. And, you know, this is a really interesting interview. I'm sure you guys are going to like it.
Yeah, so Tony's coming up on the show in around half an hour from now. Before then, of course, every week we keep a beady eye on all the stories that are happening in the world of retro gaming. And we actually have a little, I've got a Facebook tab where every time I see something, I just click on save. And then end of the week, we've got a nice little collection. We all do that. And obviously we have a Discord as well where our listeners kind of dump stories in there too. So if you ever spot anything you think would make a good news story, join us on Discord. Because I don't think we've talked about Discord on the show for quite a while now, have we?
No, and it's quite good. Like, we have different sections in there as well. And we have like the backers chat, and we have a new one, which is the music channel, which Kat demanded. And it's pretty cool having the music channel, because you can just like share some cool tunes and, you know, there's a lot of like similar culture and stuff that goes with video games as well.
Yeah, so this is one that a lot of people posted in our Discord. And a headline that's been everywhere over the last week, that Apple has finally officially retired the iPod. Now, there is an article on techradar.com. They put the subheading in there, "The iPod plays its last track." Now, of course, we're not talking about, you know, the old scroll wheel iPods that got discontinued, God, probably about 10 years ago now, I think, didn't they? But we're talking about the iPod Touch. Now, I must admit, I didn't realise they even still sold the iPod Touch.
I know a lot of people that got iPods because they didn't want kids to have phones and have that kind of phone connectivity, but have the iPod and have something that they could play with. And it was a cool kind of device in that way.
I knew they were still going, but that's because I follow Metal Jesus, and I know he's a really big iPod fan. Like, he like buys, he does videos on them and stuff. Like, he tries to collect like every single variant and stuff like that, which is really interesting. But I didn't realize, you know, kind of like when the iPhone came out in 2007 and stuff, and around the early 2010s, like when iPhone really blew up, I didn't even realize like the touch was a thing. Like, my first kind of like seeing the touch, you know, with the touch screen and everything, was the iPhone. You know, I didn't realize you could essentially, you know, get an iPhone, which was without the phone. You know, I didn't realize, I had it the wrong way around in my head, if that makes sense. Like, I was like, oh, an iPod Touch is an iPhone without the phone, where it's actually, no, an iPhone is an iPod Touch with the phone capability. But like you say, you don't really see many people, you don't see people really using them anymore, like in the street and stuff like that. At least I don't. Apparently they sold 39 million of them, you know, of the iPod in general. But I feel like it would have been a lot more than that. But I'm assuming from 2007, the sales kind of dipped massively because of the iPhone, I imagine. And it kind of makes sense that they are discontinuing it because of, you know, the technology essentially exists in iPads and iPhones, and that's what people buy now, I guess.
Never.
Yeah, and I think that's the case because, you know,
disagree.
Have you mentioned then about people getting their kids, you know, iPod Touches? But I think most, you know, most of my relatives, their kids have got iPads, you know, iPad minis, generally what they have, you know, if you want like a tablet without a phone interface.
For me, it was like, there's a lot of high-res audio players out there there's like, I know, and this isn't retro gaming. This is, I know we're talking about audio, but it's still kind of in that vein. There's lots of high-res audio players out there, and I think there's a big market for it. And those are bloody ear pods. I hate them so much. They have spatial audio in them, and these ones don't have spatial audio in the iPod. So I think it might be a decision of Apple to kind of drop them. Even in the world of like streaming media and stuff, I still think there's a place for having an iPod, even just in your car, just have that selection of tunes, or you know, if you're offline, if you're in a building that's got huge concrete walls and you can't kind of get a connection, you know, and also higher quality, high res and stuff. I think maybe it's a decision by Apple. I miss them, and I think there's lots of MP3 players out there as well. Lots of high res ones that I've seen that are really good quality, and also the Zune as well, which was cool.
Bring back Zune.
Yeah.
What was your guys' go to MP3 players then? Was it iPods? Did you both have iPods?
Oh, mine, yeah.
Yeah, the first
iPod I got, yeah, the first ever one in 2002.
And you had the Nano, did you, Ravi?
Yeah. And then I had before that, I had a Creative audio thing. But also, I don't know, some of the iPods did actually have a few games on them as well. Even the like little jog wheel early ones had a.
Yeah,
I think
like
it was Arkanoid on there as well.
Yeah, Arkanoid, yeah.
Yeah, broke it.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit of an iPod collector as well, kind of unintentionally. It got to a stage where I think, you know, around the time when everyone started getting smartphones, a lot of my friends and relatives started to like retire their iPods. And for some reason, they always say, oh, do you want this? So I've got a drawer full. I've got about 25, 30 iPods, I think. I think I did actually get them out on our patrons hangout once. I was going through the drawer and just kind of pulling out any ones I could find. And yeah, the first ever iPod, you know, I actually got a new battery for mine. And I did start to use it again a couple of years ago, just, you know, for a bit of novelty. But I must admit, even though I've got all these MP3 players, I know you said, Ravi, it's quite nice to have your own music collection in your pocket. But I must admit, I don't really find a situation when I'd use it anymore. I mean, even in the car, I've got, you know, an in-car Alexa, and I've got a USB hub in the car, so I can put a USB stick in, you know, if I want to play my own audio.
Like a little time machine, though, like picking one of the old iPods, charging it up and going, oh my God, I was listening to this. And then straight away, you're kind of taken back to that,
you know what?
Time period.
It was not particularly retro, and it was on my iPhone, but that kind of happened to me today. So I was coming home from work in the office, and me and my wife share Spotify, and I put my Spotify on, and it instantly started playing Disney lullaby songs because it was quite late. So I knew she was putting my daughter to bed. So I was like, okay, I can't listen to Spotify, so I'll go on my iTunes. And I started using Spotify about 6 or 7 years ago. So I haven't downloaded a song on iTunes in like 7 years. And it was such like a nostalgic flashback to like my life in my early 20s kind of thing, like what I was listening to then. So I would love to fish out one of my old iPods or something, or one of my old MP3 players, and see what I was listening to.
Mine was full of video game music as well. So
yeah.
I had quite a few like game soundtracks in there and stuff. And I do like the idea of kind of modifying and stuff, but you know, I just want to keep it going. Like, the streaming, I'm not the biggest fan.
What was that
fan.
Thing? It was Rockbox or something. I remember modding an iPod to run like Linux or something years ago.
Yeah. And now you can run like on the 7th generation, the new ones, you can play Fortnite. So, you know.
Oh, wow.
They're still kind of pretty all right for gaming and stuff. But it seems that Apple, just the phone dominates, doesn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely dominates. So they're probably just like, yeah, let's just go with that.
The end of an era, though. I mean, you know, that brand just changed the world, didn't it? You know, 21 years ago when that initial iPod landed, you know, just what a revolution. And I think really the company, the product that you could thank for kind of saving Apple and really pushing them to where they are today, really. You know, it was the start of all that, wasn't it, in the early 2000s?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. For me, it was really what kind of like put Apple in my mind, if that makes sense. Like, you know, before that, it was just, you know, the colourful computers, like geeks used them, and all of a sudden the iPod came out and it was cool, you know, to have one and listen to music on the go and stuff like that, like especially like for my school and stuff like that. So 100% agree with that.
And they totally stole that advertising campaign from Amiga, you know, when they had the light silhouettes and the people listening and dancing. That was like, you know, the Amiga demos back in the days when you had the silhouettes.
State of the art and stuff.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I mean, there is actually, you can watch on YouTube, I think it's called Apple Music Event 2001, If you search it on YouTube, you actually see Steve Jobs introducing the first iPod. Such a low-key event. It's literally like in a conference room at Apple's HQ, probably around like 40 people in front of him. You know, massive difference compared to just a few years later up there on stage at like WWDC, getting streamed around the world, yeah. All that kind of thing. So, yeah, the humble beginnings of the iPod are quite interesting to look back on. So, if I can track that down, I'll put that in our show notes as well. And rest in peace, iPod. Now, something else that's been around for what feels like forever that we're not going to be able to buy anymore is an EA FIFA game, because it turns out after almost 30 years, EA is officially ditching the FIFA brand.
You say that like the three of us buy FIFA every year.
I
like when you were like, we won't be able to buy it. I get it. I get it. I know.
A lot of people do.
I was going to say, I know what you're saying, our listeners, we don't buy FIFA. But yeah, I've read the article and I really, really, really tried to get my head around it. I don't understand what FIFA is.
Okay,
I just thought it was the name of the game. So
FIFA is like the governing board of football, right?
Okay, that makes sense now too.
So EA, who has the EA Sports division, has to buy all the licensing for the mm-hmm. club names, for every single player to have them in, the mm-hmm. likeness for the players as well, you know, like all their faces, all of this. All of that branding is like done through FIFA.
And all licensed to FIFA.
Yeah, and it always has been. And that's been like back in the days when you had games like Sensible Soccer and stuff, people would, you know, just put made up teams in. But also they would put teams in and there wouldn't be like, you know, the strictness about it and the chance of getting sued and stuff. But now it's all FIFA. And they basically had the renewal of the license. So the renewal of this license, and FIFA wanted more than double the amount of money for it.
Yeah.
And $1 billion apparently for one World Cup cycle, which is 4 years.
Yeah. So to have the rights to the World Cup and all of those kind of teams and stuff. And EA decided, no, we're going to go separately. And I guess they're going to kind of go and say, we're EA. And, you know, do we have permission to have your team on there, or sort the licensing themselves and start their own sports game, which will pretty much probably be exactly the same engine and stuff,
yeah,
which is EA Sports FC. But the problem is that FIFA, they started adding all these crazy stuff like NFTs and all of this. But we're the retro hour, so we're going to talk about like the retro FIFA and stuff. And like my memory of it was there were lots of little games. There were like Micro Pro Soccer. There was Sensible World of Soccer, there was Kickoff, there was ISS Pro, which was another one, International Superstar Soccer, and they all got destroyed by FIFA. FIFA ended up dominating, and it was just that continual release, constant upgrading of the technology. It was kind of like GTA, you know, how GTA just kind of upgraded with the technology and the style. And I just remember it as like when I was a kid, we'd be playing FIFA and there was this one version. I think it was FIFA 96 or something. And it was basically the referee could only give you a red card if he actually came to you.
He can only give you a red card if he catches you, and you can just run around forever, can't you?
Yeah. And he's just chasing you. I love it.
For me, you see, the last football game I played was Italia 90 for the Mega Drive. So that's like how out of touch I am with it.
Yeah, that would be one that kind of got destroyed. There was Pro Evo as well later on and stuff.
You know,
Because I remember playing FIFA on my friend's Mega Drives at school and I'd completely forgotten them. I mean, when I was kind of looking at the old FIFA games, when the story came up, I forgot that FIFA came out on the Amiga.
Yeah, it came out on a Amiga on the consoles. It was an EA thing, you know. EA were with the Amiga, you know, back in the day. So yeah,
I was watching a video of it, and it's kind of like, because they're all that kind of isometric kind of side on view, weren't they? That's what made it different from a lot of the overhead football games.
Yeah,
you know, like a Kickoff and
it was the realism. It was always the realism that they go for. Where something like Sensible Soccer, you know, that's fun. You know, that's about fun, speed and kind of tactics. But FIFA was like the realism, and that did kind of suck at some points, and it did suck with some upgrades. But later on, they just pumped money into it, and they they managed to grab the whole audience until it became a real kind of cult thing.
Well, I remember in the 2000s, you know, with my friends at school and stuff, it was always like, are you going to get FIFA or are you going to get Pro Evo, you know, on like PS2 and stuff like that. But now I don't even hear anything about Pro Evo. I don't even know if they're still going. It is literally just FIFA.
Yeah.
It is literally just FIFA is the the dominant, like, sports game, you know.
When I think it's game. Just literally left loads of, like, dead football brands.
IPs and stuff,
yeah. So, just looking at the list of platforms it's been on, it's like, it was on the Gizmondo. It was on the N-Gage. Oh, wow. There was a DOS version, GameCube.
3DO one was
Saturn,
good.
Yeah. Java. So,
I know we're going off a tangent here. We're going more into football than retro. But if there's now going to be EA Sports FC, how are they going to buy the rights if they're not doing it? Or do they just buy the rights through FIFA?
You know what I think FIFA are going to do? I think they're just going to go to another developer.
They've already said they are.
Yeah, oh. Yeah.
And so then there's already been a bit of a war going on.
It's going to be the new war, which will be the
EA Sports FC versus FIFA.
Yeah, well, they said the other day, one of the, I can't remember who it was, but there was a spokesperson from FIFA who said there will be a new FIFA game coming out. I think they're trying to find like a new studio to make it, and that will be the official FIFA game, he was saying. A lot of comments saying, you know, they wonder who they're going to get to do it. It could turn out to be really bad, but yeah.
And it's such huge news that I was sitting there watching the news at 10, and the news at 10 suddenly went, FIFA brand is over. I was like, what? This is a main kind of news story, but I guess it's so big and so significant, you know. But yeah, I can see them totally going to Epic Games or someone and creating a new FIFA that's all licensed. Or
I remember playing, like I said, on the Mega Drive. I think the last version that, you know, I could actually probably play of FIFA was on the 3DO. After that, I go around friends' houses and, you know, they've got a PlayStation 5 and they'll be like, oh, do you want to play FIFA? And I'm like, oh, if we have to, because I'm not into football. But I don't know who I am on the screen. I'm looking, I'm like, which one am I then? It kind of got a bit.
One of the PS3 FIFAs I played at like pre-drinks in like 2013. And my friend beat me like 40-0. Like, and I was just, I don't even know what I'm doing. And like, they all thought it was the funniest thing ever. Oh, Joe the gamer. And I'm just like, I don't even know which one I am on the screen. Like, you handed me a controller and not told me.
I've played it quite a bit, the recent ones as well, and all of the new ones, because I kind of learned the new game.
Were you playing it on Stadia?
I was playing the new one. And the problem with it is, as with many games at the moment, pay to win, NFTs, digital products that you can buy, that all kind of makes it a bit unfair. And I really didn't like the way that it was going. And you get that with so many franchises nowadays where, you know, you can spend all this extra money and earn bucks and dollars and all of this stuff. And yeah, it just wasn't my kind of game. I'd play it solo. I wouldn't connect with anyone online. I'd, you know, just stay in my own world away from all of that kind of stuff.
Stick to the Mega Drive version, Rev.
Yeah, exactly. You can't get a pay to win on a cartridge.
You know what it does mean, though, now that there's going to be no more EA FIFA games? Does that mean, like, charity shops are suddenly going to run out of games in, like, 10 years?
Run out of FIFA games which are dusty on the shelves, maybe.
They'll be using it as, like, roofing and stuff.
I've tiled my house with old FIFA 2009 for the Xbox 360.
Because there were so many versions. It came out every year. And
every console.
Do you remember FIFA Street as well, which was another one that they did on the... I think that was on the Dreamcast, and they had a whole like street football thing, and they tried to.
I think
to
it was
totally,
PS2 as well. Yeah, I remember.
Yeah,
all
totally
that
tried to change
stuff.
It. Yeah,
yeah.
It was definitely. I mean, there's not many. I can't think of any other franchises in, you know, video games history that's been on that many platforms and has lasted that long. You know, 30 years. That's incredible. So, big change coming up in football games. So we'll keep an eye on that story. And if you want to check out this article reminiscing on some of the classic ones on Eurogamer, I'll link that up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, I need to talk about this amazing new version of Portal for the Nintendo 64 and Wolfenstein 3D's 30th Anniversary Edition, which looks really cool. And, of course, our special guest, Tony Warner, on the way soon. Before we do that, just a quick message to say, if you enjoy what we do on the Retro Hour podcast each week, could you find it in your heart just to throw a few quid, a few dollars, a few euros into the tip jar and help us pay the bills, because we do have a patron that really, as we've said before, is the lifeblood of this podcast.
Totally. It's a great friendship group as well. You know, we were just talking about Discord earlier, and we have a great backers chat section in there. And, you know, we have the patron meetups as well, where we all get to talk to each other and kind of share knowledge and also kind of share interesting things that people have found. And we've also got the After Hours podcast as well, which we decided to do a new one. And I can't damn mention this, and I can't believe that we haven't actually covered this in the After Hours.
Yeah, we're doing a Nintendo 64 special. So I'm
Joe's like,
I am literally like, yeah, I'm like licking my lips to that. It's like, I can talk about N64 all day. So as soon as Dan suggested it, I was just like, yeah, you know, N64 was such a big part of my childhood and stuff. So if you want to hear me blabbering on about the N64 for about an hour or two on the After Hours podcast, then definitely this month is a good month to sign up. And, you know, how many episodes have we done that now? Have we
23?
I was going to say, have we passed 20 now? So you will unlock all 23 episodes and 24 then, episodes as well.
Some of them are like 2 hours long. They're not just limited to kind of 1 hour, you know, because we're so passionate about the subjects, you know, so you do get a lot.
Yeah, we go through our top five games on each system as well, don't we? It's always so much fun doing the system episodes of the After Hours podcast. So if you want to get access to that, if you're a gold member or above, you get that every month. You also will get invited to our patrons hangout that's coming up this weekend on Sunday when Ravi's back victorious from his DJ battle. You'll be in a celebrating mood, I'm sure.
Hungover.
Probably. We're doing that this coming Sunday evening from 8 p.m. So it would be incredible to see you there. You also get the normal podcast ad-free. You get it early some weeks as well, if I can get the editing done in time. You also get extra content in there. We do a few extra stories just for our patrons each week. But really the reason that you're doing it is just to make sure that we can keep the lights on, keep the bills paid as well, and make sure that a new podcast comes out every single Friday for, you know, what can be as little as a, you know, and it's a cliche in the world of patron, but it could be as little as a cost of a cup of coffee, you know, once a month to help this podcast continue. And of course, for making a contribution into our Patreon, you will find your place in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming, and that is
Hall of Fame.
The Retro Hour Hall of Fame. And a big thank you to our latest supporters. Thanks to Tony Davis,
Shane and Scott,
and Asbestos Long,
who all backed us on Patreon. And if you'd like to find your place in the Hall of Fame, all the details to sign up to our Patreon are on our website at theretrohour.com. Someone actually asked if you sang that jingle live every week.
So I got a message from Adam Battersby, my friend, and he said, I think you're singing Hall of Fame live on the podcast. I'm not every time. That's pre-recorded. And I think Asbestos Long might be my friend Bruce Asbestos, who's an artist pretty awesome dude.
I do find myself the other day after I edited last week's show, it's in the kitchen going, Hall of Fame. So it didn't get stuck in the head, Revan. Catchy. Right, then a few more stories to get into this week. Now, this one I thought was really cool and something that I'm desperate to play, actually. Someone's done a version of Portal that looks pretty playable, actually, for the N64.
This looks really, really cool. So it is just kind of not even a demo at the moment. At the moment, it's just kind of like a project video.
Proof of concept
video. Yeah, thank you for that, Ravi. So this comes from a programmer, James Lambert, who has been essentially porting Portal to the N64. But what I really want to make clear, and what he wants to really stress and make clear, is this isn't like a retro version of Portal that looks like an N64 version. This is actually running on N64 hardware. Like, he is developing it on N64, like, you know, programming software, and then running it on the N64. So at the moment, it's, you know, not playable for the public or anything like that, but like I say, proof of concept, it looks really, really, really cool. And it's clearly Portal. And, you know, the first thing that he wanted to do is, you know, on the video, is he made it clear there's no sound effects in there. There isn't even any animation on you firing the portal gun. It is literally, you just fire it, you just pull the trigger, and it just appears, the portal on the wall. But the reason it's like that is it was just, he wanted to see if he could actually get the portal engine to work. Because obviously he's built this engine from the ground up. He has built the engine himself. He's not using like Mario 64's engine or, you know, Banjo-Kazooie's or anything like that. He's had to build the engine from scratch, and essentially he wanted to just see if the technology would work like that, if he you know, walk through the portal, it will work like it does in the, you know, the modern, I say modern, but in the 2007 PC Xbox 360 game. And it did. And not only did he get it working, he also got it so that when you look through the portal without going through it, you do see, you know, how you would in the original game, like you see into the room. So if you put the portal in front of you and then behind you, you would see the character kind of thing. He's actually got that all working, which is really good. At the moment, he's got...
And you can do it four levels deep.
Four levels deep, which is amazing. Yeah, it's limited to four levels deep at the moment.
Which is a lot.
Which is a lot, yeah. So he's you know, said that he's definitely going to carry on with it and carry on making it. So I'll be really interested to see, you know, if he can get it. Because in the actual original game, when you shoot the portal like starts off small and it grows bigger, like, you know, really quickly. So it'd be really interesting if he can get it like that and stuff. But... you know, it looks good as well. It looks like a really nice N64 game. So really, really cool one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, because I remember being obsessed with that when I got it in Orange Box on the 360. It's one of those games that when you kind of figure out, I think I booted it once and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing, and I turned it off. Then another time, I kept hearing how good it was. And when I got into it, though, God, I was completely hooked on that game. Great story.
I love the music, but even the mention of the word portal makes me motion sick. And like the idea of it on the N64 is like, oh God, just with the lower frame rate and stuff. Oh God, yeah.
You know, it's quite interesting because Giles Goddard, who was one of the, you know, programmers at Nintendo back in the day, Nintendo legend, really. And he mentioned that when they were putting together Ocarina of Time, they actually did like a tech demo of Portals then, you know, obviously back in the late 90s. So, you know, it is something that the N64 was kind of always capable of, I guess. But yeah, this looks really cool. And I mean, it's just something that I hope it kind of develops into a more fully featured game that we can download and play on the N64, because really, when you think about it, at its heart, I guess Portal is a pretty simplistic puzzle game, really, isn't it? You know, it's but there's a physics and everything that makes it, I guess, complicated to do on classic hardware.
I was going to say, there is that really good video on YouTube by that guy, Dan Wood, who goes on about how the N64 was actually a powerhouse. There you go, a little plug for you.
Supercomputer.
So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that it can do it, and, you know, that other developers have kind of reached out and said, you know, like you say, doing it on Ocarina of Time and stuff like that to see if it works. So it's cool that it'll do it, but it is interesting to see if he gets a full kind of game going or if it's just like one level. Do you know what I mean?
He's said that he's going to have to reduce the amount of portals that you can do, but I reckon that would probably lead to some redesigns of levels, or maybe using the simpler levels, or like the ones with the less amount of stuff in there and using other dynamics.
Yeah, I think what we might end up with in the end is like a 6-level or 10-level, like simple kind of like mode. Like, you know, he won't necessarily port the levels from the original game. He'll just make some small levels himself, maybe. I think that's what will happen. I can't see it being a full port in the end just because of it won't. I just can't see it running or fitting. Do you know what I mean? I mean, obviously, it'll be on like an EverDrive or on a ROM or something. But, you know, for it to actually run on N64 hardware is going to be a tough job, but also a massive labour of love.
You know what, though, as well, because, I mean, I love Portal 1 and Portal 2, and it's made me realise saying this, you know, we haven't had a new Portal game for 11 years now, which, you know, that's such a big series, it kind of feels like it's long overdue, like Portal 3 or something.
It's the whole Valve can't count to 3 thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it is good for Portal fans to have something new to play, though, so hopefully we'll see this coming out for the N64. A game that celebrated a big anniversary this month, and obviously a legendary game, talk about industry changers, Wolfenstein 3D celebrated its 30th anniversary on May the 5th when that game first came out back in 1992. I remember seeing that. I mean, you know, I've talked about how I used to randomly go to Ryman's, the stationers, the stationery shop, to see all the cutting-edge new PC games, quite bizarrely, back in the day. I do remember playing Wolfenstein in there, though, and Doom, and just being blown away at that game when I first saw it. But now, 30 years later, some fans have actually made a 30th anniversary edition of Wolfenstein 3D.
Yeah, this edition looks pretty good, actually, because it's supported on DOS. So, you know, you're going old school, but it's also supported on SDL. And SDL, if you don't know about it, is Simple Direct Media Layer. And it basically means that it can be worked on different hardware and operating systems. So Amiga OS supports it, later versions. And the kind of PowerPC ones, Riscos, Haiku, Linux. So, you know, there's a lot of options for this. And I think it's quite cool, these mods being released and like a lot of extra content.
Yeah, I mean, they've actually done. I mean, it's a fan-made unofficial expansion pack for Wolfenstein 3D. So they've got 30 new levels in here, which is massive. 10 levels in each new episode, 2 new guns in there as well. And also, I think this is quite a useful feature they've put in the game too, an auto map for orientation purposes. Because I'd often find that with, because you know, Wolfenstein is very much a maze game, isn't it? And I don't know whether it's just the way my brain works, but whenever I play games that involve mazes, I generally end up getting lost and getting really annoyed at myself.
Yeah, I mean, I get lost with a map even in the early Doom games. So I don't know if one on Wolfenstein 3D would help me that much, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, the problem with Wolfenstein is a lot of levels look very similar.
And there's all the secret doors and stuff like that in it as well. But, I mean, if you get to blow away Hitler, I'm sold.
Robot Hitler. Rock
mecha Hitler, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he was removed in some versions, but then in other ones, he was allowed. So he's going to be in this one because it's a mod, isn't it?
It's got to be.
So this looks loads of fun, and it's just dropped now as well, so you can download it for free. And only 961 people have downloaded this so far, so get on this. I'll link that up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, before we get into our chat this week with Tony Warner, the co-founder of Revolution Software, talking about some classic adventure games, let's give a big thank you to this week's sponsor, and that is our wonderful friends at ExpressVPN. Now, obviously, we've all got our phones with us at all time, and I don't know about you, you know, my iPhone is by far my most used computer, my most used internet device. The scary thing is that we all know this, you know, deep down, that your phone collects so much data, your phone carrier can record all this as well and spy on whatever you're doing. And, you know, some carriers like Verizon in America have even admitted that they're doing this. They say it's so they can get a better understanding of your interests, but in reality, we know what they're doing. They're collecting this to sell to advertisers. So, I mean, not everyone's comfortable with that. You know, some people don't mind. But thing is, if you want stuff like, you know, the sites you visit and what you've been up to online to be your personal business, then why don't you check this out? ExpressVPN. Now, Ravi, I mean, you're our resident, you know, privacy advocate. You have been as long as I've known you. And ExpressVPN is a service that you've used for as long as I've known you as well.
Oh, totally. Like this, it was essential. I recently went on holiday to America for a month. And before I could get my kind of contract sorted, I was connecting to so many Wi-Fi networks in airports, random hotels, totally unsecure places, really, just to get that kind of connection and get some data. And every time I went there, you know, I fired up ExpressVPN and I knew that I'd kind of be safe. And it's really awesome. It's really fast as well, really simple to have on all your devices. So I had it on my laptop. Had it on my phone as well. And just a really great service.
Yeah, and it's dead easy to use as well, isn't it? Literally tap a button.
So simple. You just select the country you want to be and connect. And I could also watch stuff from the UK whilst I was in America at a really fast speed.
Yeah, now not only do they shield your web browsing, but ExpressVPN protects and encrypts all of your network data so you can stay private even when using apps on your phone as well, whether it's, you know, iPhone, Android, even a tablet user as well. ExpressVPN works on all your devices. The best part is one subscription can be used on up to 5 devices at the same time, so you can get, you know, the whole family on ExpressVPN. So why don't you do this? If you're sick of companies, you know, tracking you and invading your privacy, have a look at expressvpn.com/retro. Use a VPN that we trust, expressvpn.com/retro. Take back your online privacy. And tell you what, if you use our link, not only will you be supporting the podcast, but also we'll give you 3 months free extra on top of a 1-year plan as well. So that's expressvpn.com/retro. And a massive thank you to our friends at ExpressVPN for their continued support. Right, next up, we're going to get some incredible stories from our special guest, co-founder of the legendary Revolution Software, Tony Warner, next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for the main event when we welcome on our very special guest. And today, I'm so excited to get some stories about Revolution Software, companies like Paragon Programming, stuff like Warhawk, Deathstalker, Beneath a Steel Sky. I love that game back in the day. With the co-founder of Revolution Software, let's welcome on Tony Warner. How are you doing, Tony?
Hey, not bad. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate you joining us. Now, before we get into those stories about these incredible companies that you've worked for, and also, you know, your own book that you're working on at the moment that I hope we can announce and maybe give that a bit of a plug at the end of the interview as well. It's always quite interesting to kind of go back to the start of our guests' kind of careers and, you know, what got them interested initially in the video games industry. I mean, do you remember when you first saw a video game? What first got your interest started?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a ZX81 a friend of mine got. And, you know, we were all sort of playing with electronics, you know, building crystal radios and stuff like that, which was kind of whatever it was, late 70s, you know. And suddenly the ZX81 popped up and I didn't quite understand what it was because you couldn't really, you know, you saw these adverts that started appearing and was it a business thing or was it like a sort of a home hobby type? No one was quite sure what it was because we'd never seen a computer before. But a friend of mine got one and I sort of pedaled over and had a look at it and it was like mind blowing, you know. This thing, it just did all sorts of different things and you could make your own thing, you make your own programs. It was just mind blowing because it was just so much more dynamic than the electronic type things we were playing with. So, you know, from that moment on, I was totally hooked.
I was wondering, like, was that your very first experience of programming then? And like, what other stuff were your peers doing at the time?
Well, as I say, I mean, I was looking at electronics as something that could be. You know, interesting, and you know, building something seemed quite exciting, but electronics was hard. You know, you'd get these kit things and you'd spend ages building it and then it wouldn't work because you didn't have quite the right parts, you know. It was just difficult with electronics, but programming seemed much more interesting because you know you couldn't break it. You'd type some lines in and it didn't work, but that was just a bug, and you edited it and fixed it, and then it iterated and iterated, and it was so much more dynamic than electronics. So, I mean, first time I did that was on my friend's ZX81, and then I think we found some BBC micros at school. They were like hidden. School didn't know what to do with them, so they hid them away in store cupboards. And we found a couple of those and used to lark around on them at lunchtime, you know. So I did a lot of BBC Basic.
Was that the time when the education program was on and just every school was getting BBC micros?
Yeah, exactly. Computer studies, yeah. I mean, they were terrified of these machines because no one knew what to do with them, you know. They gave them to the maths teachers and said, right, it must be maths, so you guys are in charge of computer studies, you know. And a few of us kids, like myself, I mean, we knew a lot more than the teachers did, and that terrified them even more, you know.
Well, I remember you mentioned those small kits. There were quite a few of them around. I used to have like an electronics kit when I was a kid, but I remember the radios were a huge little thing as well. Did anybody have like kit computers as well, or was it all kind of just the made ones?
You could actually buy. I didn't see one or know anybody who did it, but you could get a ZX81 in kit form and literally solder it together yourself, and it was like, I don't know, £5 cheaper or something, you know. You see them occasionally on eBay in kit form still, you know, unmade, which and they're expensive now, of course, because people probably did make them, you know, and screw them up or whatever. So to find an unmade ZX81 kit on, and probably the ZX80 as well, you see them occasionally. So, I mean, some people made them, yeah.
Did you find that most people were buying them to learn programming, or was it a case of I just want a computer, so I'll buy one, then figure out what to do with it later?
I think the kids were going, you know, they say to your dad, you know, I can learn to program on it, and what you really meant was I'll get into games and play some games on it. You know, people, a lot of my friends, we all started programming and made a bit of progress, and I kind of went a bit further and learned assembly code and stuff, and that's where you got serious about it. And most of my friends, they kind of veered off and just ended up playing games, you know.
Well, you also had an interesting system. It's called a Computers Lynx.
Yeah.
We'd never actually heard of that before, and it seems like it was a kind of British micro. Can you tell us about that and, like, what was available for it and what kind of stuff did you do on it?
Well, you see, my friend had this ZX81, and then I think I just missed Christmas. This was the thing. So I was like 12 or something or 13, and I just missed Christmas. So I started saving up and I was going to get a ZX81. And I think the ZX Spectrum came out, and then I thought, oh, it's a bit more expensive, but it's so much better. So I switched to saving it for a ZX Spectrum. And then this other thing called the Lynx started appearing in advertising. And I read some stuff about it, and I thought this might actually be better for programming, because it had a thing called a machine code monitor, which I didn't really understand what it was, but it was a program that just slightly helped you mess about with assembly stuff. So I kind of thought, this would be better. And I quite liked the spec on it. And it had it was a Z80 processor, like the Sinclair machines, which I figured was the one to go for. And it had a proper keyboard, and I thought, I just like the look of it and I like the advertising. So I kind of switched and started saving up for that instead, because it wasn't, these machines, they weren't actually too expensive, surprisingly enough. I mean, it was a couple of hundred quid, but, and the Spectrum was like 180, a 48K Spectrum, 180 quid, something like that. So it didn't seem that much more to keep on saving, you know. I mean, it was a lot of paper rounds, but it seemed like a thing to do. And I often go for slightly strange offbeat decisions and choices. So the links seem like an interesting alternative way to go, you know, but it turned out to be a disaster, because they raised some money and they designed what was a pretty nice machine. I mean, it did everything it was meant to do, and I really liked it, but I think they made like 6,000 of them and then went bankrupt.
Yeah, it's pretty mad. I've never really heard of it before, but the basic was much better on there and faster, and it was at a higher resolution as well.
It was funny, yeah. I mean, there was the only problem with it was there was something about the screen refresh that made it a bit slower than you'd want it to be. So it wasn't actually perfect, but you could write a decent game on it. Sprites and stuff you could do. I mean, it wasn't much more powerful than the Spectrum in truth, but it was, you know, the keyboard was a lot better. It didn't have that funny keyword system that Sinclair liked. So I think it was more, you know, it was more practical in some ways. You could get into it a lot better. So, you know, it was good to have, but it didn't last, certainly. There was like two games for it, I think. there was a Pac-Man game, which I've still got the cassette for, but, you know, not much else.
Was that why you decided you wanted to make your own games then, just a lack of software, or what kind of got your interest there to start programming games yourself?
It's just I don't know, I just like making things, and the possibility was quite exciting. You could do anything, you could write any game, and it just appealed, you know. It was just cool. And then, you know, you started reading magazines like Crash and Zap, and in those early years in the 80s, it was absolutely amazing, because every month someone would make a major breakthrough in terms of tech and gameplay on the Spectrum. You know, like people like Ultimate Play the Game and Gargoyle Games, and you know, all those guys. That every month the games would get better, and it was just totally exciting. You know, you just couldn't believe what was coming out, and just to be part of that, the idea that you might yourself come up with something great was. It was just so much more exciting than the rest of the world, you know, if you see what I mean.
I read that your first game was Obsidian. And I read that, is this rumour true that you actually suffered a bit of school in terms of your studies because you were working too much on that game instead of revising for exams?
It's absolutely true, yeah. I mean, it's a story often told, but I'd fallen out with school in a big, big way. So, I mean, they blocked me from doing the computer course that we spoke about earlier, because I was not a good student at school. I didn't really excel in any way, and I was like bottom set on pretty much everything. So, you know, they found a way to block me from doing the computer studies course. So I just thought, well, I'm looking at the magazines and saying, look at all these games. I reckon I can do this. So why do I need to go through all this school stuff? You know, why don't I just forget about all that and write games instead? You know. It's kind of a bold move, really, but it's paid off, I suppose, because I'm still doing it, 40 years later. So I didn't really miss those O-levels that I failed.
Well, how did you end up like meeting Charles and getting involved with Arctic?
I switched once the links had gone down. I then saved up again and got an Amstrad CPC 464, which was... ultra perfect, you know. It was amazing because it solved all the problems with screens and graphics, and it was a lovely machine. And then disk drives came out for it, so you could seriously, you know, you could much more seriously develop stuff and not have to save things on tape and go through all the disasters that that would entail. So you could really get into programming properly on the Amstrad. So, you know, this is like 1985, I suppose, and I just started writing this game while the exams were on, and finished it sort of some in the late summer. And then, you know, what you did was you made your demo and you put it onto a load of cassettes and sent it off to all the publishers. My mother looked through the local Yellow Pages and saw that there was a company called Arctic, which was about 20 miles away from where we were. So she said, well, send it to these guys, because if they're looking for people, you might go work there, you know, which is exactly what happened. So, I mean, I posted it off to Arctic, and I got a letter back a few days later from this guy, Charles Cecil, who said, come and have a chat to us, because we like the game. And the rest is history.
Well, what was the relationship with Firebird and Arctic? I know they worked together.
And I mean, not initially. It was very much an Arctic game. And then I suppose towards the end, I mean, Arctic was in a kind of difficult, I mean, it had had a lot of success in the earlier 80s, the Spectrum stuff. And then it started to suffer a bit towards the mid to late 80s, kind of the time that I was there, really. It was starting to go down, and they were kind of hoping Obsidian would pull them out of the hole, and it didn't quite, really. And we wrote another game in there called Ultima Ratio, and we did that was an Arctic production. And then I guess they started licensing stuff out just to try and raise money towards the end. But there was a lot of weird things going on, and Charles said, I've had enough of this, and he formed Paragon Programming, which the task for that company was going to be to do porting work for US Gold and people like that. And he said, come and work for this company. So me and the other guys there, we all jumped ship from Arctic and went to work for Paragon.
I was going to say, when Charles kind of went off and started working with US Gold under Paragon, did you kind of see this as like, right, US Gold, they're bringing in big titles, this is going to be a good kind of partnership for the future in Paragon?
Yeah, well, it was just something to do, really. My idea was always to write original games, but we weren't really sure what to do. And Charles said, look, this is a good opportunity, and we'll earn some money doing this, and then we can think about originals when we've got some money in the bank, you know. So we did like... I think I probably did two or three games at Paragon, and it was actually doing pretty well, but too well in a way, because US Gold then turned around and said, well, Charles, you know, you're doing all our ports for us. Why don't you come and actually be development manager in Birmingham and run the show, you know? So, you know, Charles said, yeah, that's not a bad idea. So he went off to US Gold, and I sort of was left kind of scratching my head a little bit. So and that company was down in London. So I trained it back to Hull and embarked on a bit of freelance work for a while.
And that's where you started like doing Deathstalker as well, which amazingly had David Whittaker as well on board doing music.
Yeah, well, I mean, that again, me and my pal Adam Waring, who was previously at Arctic, you know, we just sat in a flat in Hull and wrote a game each. And I did Deathstalker, he did Ninja Massacre. And we wrote them in, what, 4 or 5 months, I suppose, maybe less than that, made a demo tape and sent them off to Codemasters, we thought was the right place. And sure enough, they accepted both games. So then we were just like working for Codemasters. And they were pretty cool and pretty interesting.
Well, what drew you to the Amstrad? And why did you think that was such a good machine?
Well, mostly because of the chip it used, to be honest. It was Z80, so it looked like a Super Spectrum, you know. And we kind of thought, well, you know, we've been burnt a little bit with these other machines that have gone down, but Amstrad seemed pretty kind of bullish about everything, so it seemed like a safe bet. And the way you got a monitor, a really nice monitor with it, and the floppy disks were coming for it, and it kind of ticked all the boxes, you know. I kind of thought it was a safe bet. I mean, in truth, it did well for a couple of years, and then it was a little bit too late. You know, like 16 bits were starting to be talked about as the Amstrad got going. I mean, if that machine had been 2 years earlier, it could have been a massive success, you know. But I mean, it did all right. but it was never Spectrum sized, you know. But it was a great machine, absolutely great machine.
What was the kind of process of porting then? So, you know, you did Deathstalker for the Spectrum and the Amstrad. Was there a kind of way of porting the code over, or was it kind of a total redo for each platform?
Well, what I had was, because prior to this, somewhere sliced in the middle of all this that we've talked about, I worked for a little bit for a company called Cascade in Harrogate, and there we did a game called 19 Boot Camp. I don't know if you remember the song 19.
Yeah, Paul Hardcastle.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
so Dan's DJ career credentials coming through.
paid off.
It was quite a funny song actually, but it was like number one for like 6 months or something. But Cascade had done this thing called 50 game cassette and earned a fortune from it. Like the boss was driving a Porsche and all this sort of thing. And they had this company up Cascade in Harrogate, and I got a job there instantly, having gone to see them. And it's a bit convoluted. We did this thing, we did the Deathstalker things, and then all that blew apart. So then I went to work for, Cascade. And what we found there was, they were using a system called PDS, which was, you'd get a very early Amstrad PC, like an 8086 based thing, an Amstrad 1640 it was, and it had a hard drive which was like astonishing. I'd never seen a hard drive before, and it had but it's basically, there was a board inside the PC and a ribbon cable that went into the back of a Spectrum or an Amstrad, and you'd write your code on the assembler program, press a button, and it would shoot it down into the Amstrad or the Spectrum, and in like half a second your game would be running. It was an absolutely brilliant system. There was all sorts of wild things happening at Cascade, and the whole thing blew apart. But in order to finish the game, I said to them, look, Give me a couple of development kits, and I'll finish the work, and then we'll all go our separate ways. So I finished this game for them, and I came out of it with two dev kits, and that's what we used to write Deathstalker and Ninja Massacre. And it was largely the same code, to be honest. I mean, you had, you know, Spectrum had a different screen and kind of input methods, but the games were largely the same thing, slightly different graphics, but it wasn't too difficult to make the same game work on both machines. He said, I don't remember it ever being difficult, you know.
We interviewed the Olivers, and you know, they were doing Codemaster stuff, and they said they used kind of exactly the same method of kind of firing it down. So maybe it was like standardized in that part of the industry then.
I mean, anybody seriously writing Commodore 64 or Spectrum was using PDS. There were a lot of pirating of those boards as well. There was a lot of dodgy PDS systems floating around, I think, including a few that I came across, because they were too expensive, basically. So you people were building their own boards, you know. But again, that was a great system, and I've not since worked on a system that was as good to use as PDS, because it was so fast.
You know, when you're doing like porting to different systems, I mean, is the kind of obviously advantages and disadvantages of working in machine code, I mean, having different processes, I mean, what's kind of the process there?
Well, I mean, the thing is, you're either 64 with a 6502 chip, or you were a Z80 target. And if you were Z80 as I was then, you know, you 95% of your code would be the same for Amstrad or Spectrum, and then you'd probably have a little thing in the, I honestly can't remember how we did it, but you'd probably have a some sort of decision point in the code where you'd either say this is the Spectrum version or this is the Amstrad version, and if it's the Spectrum one, then this is how you draw a sprite, and if this is the Amstrad version, then you use this code instead, you know, and you would toggle which the target was, and it would change the program and fire it down, you know. That's pretty much it. It was pretty simple, really.
I was wondering, you did a title called Arcade Trivia Quiz, and that that was an interesting little title, and it also had like a kind of questions editor, which is pretty cool. Yeah, like a kind of add-on. Did you see any versions that people have made or anything, and what's the kind of history behind that title?
The history of that title is quite funny, actually, because that was going to be a Codemasters game. That's where we fell out with Codemasters. They turned a bit strange, because we did Deathstalker and Ninja Massacre, and then they really liked those two games, and they did quite well with them. And then they didn't really work with us on what we would do next. So we kind of came up with some ideas and they didn't like them. And then we thought, we don't have any money. The way it worked was there was no advances, and you'd write a game and then it would go off to market, and there'd be quite a gap between you sending off the final master tape and actually getting any royalties, because the royalties would be every 3 months, and there'd be like 2 months prepping the you know, like manufacturing tapes and all of that stuff. It's quite a slow process. So, you know, you'd write a game, you'd have no money whatsoever. You'd write a game, send it off. They'd say, okay, that's great, we accept it, it's going to go off to publishing. But, you know, you wouldn't see any money for 4-5 months, something like that. So we were all absolutely skinned with our dev kits and wondering what to do next. So we thought, we'll do one of these pub trivia, because there was these machines in the pubs where you'd play the trivia questions like Trivial Pursuit, but on a arcade machine type thing. We'd been playing these things down the pub. And we thought, why don't we just do one of those? And it'll be so easy, because all you need is questions, and then the front end is like super simple. There'd be nothing to it, you know. We could do it in a week or something, you know. so we had this brilliant idea. And first of all, we couldn't sell it to Codemasters, and then they backtracked slightly on the whole thing and decided it was their idea, and that we couldn't do it. So we all fell out basically. They did their own. If you look at Codemasters' back catalogue, they actually did their own version, which is what they threatened they would do. It was all very strange. We couldn't understand why they didn't just get us to do it. So there's two versions. The one we did, which went to Zeppelin Games up in Newcastle, and their version as well, I think. And they did a Fruit Machine one as well. So they did a pub trivia, because everything was simulator everything was a simulator at Codemasters. So they did a pub trivia simulator, I think, and a Fruit Machine simulator, and we did ours that went to Zeppelin. But once it went out, I mean, that was the end of it. I never got a penny for it, I don't think. I don't think they sold any either. I mean, you never see it on eBay or anything. I think I have a copy, but that's as far as it goes.
Might be really rare now. It might be worth a lot on eBay.
It might be, yeah.
Well, like, I heard that you guys looked at some Sierra titles before, and what did you kind of think of those Sierra games?
Yeah, well, Charles said, come and let's get together, you know, and I'll tell you what it's about when we get there. So two of us from Bytron, this company was called the Aeronautics people, we basically didn't know what Charles wanted, but, you know, we thought, we'll see what he has to say. So we drove up to the very northern tip of North Wales, where Charles's family has this little cottage thing. And we met there, and Charles had a PC unloaded from his car, and he said, look at these. And we had Leisure Suit Larry and a King's Quest game, and we spent like a day playing those games. And Charles was saying, down at Activision, you know, we handle the UK publishing for Sierra, and these games do pretty well. Could you write the same thing? Could you write the engine? And we looked at it and said, yeah, shit, it looks all right. It's just sprites, you know, and stuff. So we said, yes, we can do that. So Charles said, okay, go away and think about it and play about with the tech, and we'll get back together again in a few months and see where we are. So, you know, he had an interest in adventures, because he'd done a series of them at Arctic much earlier, like Adventure A, Adventure B, Adventure C. It might have been a D as well. So he already had an interest in adventures, but then he saw them again in the graphic adventure form at Activision, and obviously he knew all about the market, because they were selling them, so that they had all the intel, you know. So that was where all of those things came together. I mean, he knew me, that I could program the games, and, you know, he knew the market, he had an interest in adventures. So all these things came together, and that was basically the beginning of Revolution.
And obviously around that time, I mean, Lucasfilm Games were one of the leaders in adventure games as well, you know, Maniac Mansion, Monkey Island, Loom, games like that. I mean, in terms of like the technical side of it and the way the games worked, for a couple of years, it felt like they were still kind of figuring out how to do user interfaces and that kind of things. Did you take much inspiration from those games then, or how did you kind of figure that out yourself?
Yeah, I mean, we looked at how we could do something better from a technical point of view, and we kind of had this idea of maybe a series of screens at once, like trying to get a whole world running at once. I mean, I quite like the Gargoyle games, like Dundurak and Marsport, where you kind of had this simulated world going on. So, you know, I was thinking, you know, could you do an adventure game where it was a whole world running at once? And Charles was quite interested in that as a way to kind of advance the genre and do something that these guys weren't. And we also went down to it was something like a micro fair, if you remember those, or it may have been a PCW show. And we went across to the Level 9 stand when they still did that kind of thing. And they were showing a game called Raj, which was doing exactly that as well. It had like several screens all running at once, so people were walking in and out of the current location, you know. And that kind of gave us the idea that what we were thinking about was the right thing, because if Level 9 were thinking about it, then, you know, we kind of felt that adventures were going to kind of move that way, which turned out to be completely wrong. But all these things happened at once, and it looked like that's what we should do to try and get a sort of tech advantage. I mean, in truth, with adventure games, you didn't really need a tech advantage, but the sort of culture of writing games was that every game would be technically better than the last one somehow, you know, like more sprites or more colors or some fancy effect, you know. There was always a technical gain that people were looking for. So, you know, running the whole
world, magazine reviews focused on those a lot of the time as well, didn't they?
Oh, they really did. Yeah, it was all, you know, how does it use the machine? How does it advance things? So yeah, you know, we could have just written a normal adventure game with a single screen and made a really great game, and it probably would have been fine, because you could have just had great graphics and a great game, and you know, an adventure game would have been okay. But you know, we said let's try and push it, and it proved to be quite valuable, because we wrote this demo where we had we could absolutely demonstrate that we had these characters walking in and out of a kind of separate, you know, we had a screen with a, what we call the Zen Garden, and there was like a shed with a doorway, and we could kind of prove that we were having characters walking in and out and bumping into each other and stuff, and Charles would take this off to Mirrorsoft and people like that, and say, look at this tech, it's going to be amazing, you know. And people liked it. They were like, wow, this is something new. So, you know, it did its job in that sense.
Well, like the rivals that we've mentioned had their own kind of game engines, and like you've been talking about the virtual theater, and lot of people know about the Scum engine and the Sierra interpreter. Was it a bit of a challenge to kind of implement a whole engine, and was that like the immediate thing that you did when you very first like started at Revolution?
Yeah, we started working on that engine, and it was not that difficult. It was bigger than anything than I'd done before, but it was manageable. And in those days, there was no internet to distract you, so we just kind of zoned in on it and hacked it out. You know, it was like real old style, just hack a game out. And you know, we'd often go up to Wales where there was even less distraction. There was nothing in Wales. There wasn't even a pub to distract you, so. We just wrote tons of code really, really quickly, and fairly soon we had the whole thing working, you know. But I mean, key to it was a scripted language that we invented, which other people were doing as well. You didn't try and all the puzzles and dialogue and stuff and all those things that happen when you interact, you know, they weren't coded in assembly like the engine was. They were written in a higher level scripted language. And all these other games, they all did the same thing. I mean, we didn't know they did, but later we found out that everyone was doing the same thing, and we just invented our own version of it, you know. So it was actually, I mean, the history is that by the time we did Broken Sword, we gave up on the whole running world thing, because we couldn't think of gameplay that fit it very well. Mm. But the scripting language turned out to be the most important thing by far, and that was used. Iterations of the version that we wrote for Lure the Temptress, they were that system was used right through to In Cold Blood, probably even Broken Sword 3.
That's like really important, because, you know, having a kind of an arms race with these interpreters and engines, like, you know, Sierra games, to me, because they were using the Scum engine until like later titles came out, they felt a bit dated, and then
right.
Having something with like a bit of a higher level of AI or you know, a bit more technology in there really seemed like a cutting edge thing and could actually, you know, sell an adventure game because the fan base was huge back then.
Well, I mean, I think Sierra were kind of running out of road, really. I don't think they quite knew where to go. I mean, the problem was, in a wider sense, that adventures were being squeezed by other genres, and Sierra and LucasArts were a lot bigger than we were. And, you know, they'd built a whole big company just doing these quite simple, I mean, technically simple, although, you know, in terms of design, they were quite sophisticated, but they were quite simple, but big but simple games, and they'd built a huge business on it. And then things started to turn and they were in trouble, you know. Revolution was a bit smaller, so we ended up sort of ducking and diving and being pushed this way and that into slightly different genres when it got really tricky for adventure games. But
You could see them all kind of going into like kind of film stuff. So, like, you know, obviously Sierra had the crazy FMV stuff, and then you had like Day of the Tentacle and stuff like that on the LucasArts film, and that was kind of moving more away from the traditional point and click, but still, you know, kind of addressing that group.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Tentacle was a genius piece of work. I mean, it doesn't get the respect that it deserves. People don't really talk about it much, but Tentacle, I thought, was brilliant.
That's when I felt they really stepped up, and like Full Throttle as well was a really interesting one. Yeah. But we'll just go back to Laura of the Temptress, because back then, like, you know, Monkey Island was a absolutely huge title on the Amiga. Did you guys want to try and kind of get into that market and also have that humor around it?
Well, we saw ourselves as being in the same market. You know, we were doing Broken Sword when Monkey Island was around. So, you know, we kind of, in the end, were thinking it's LucasArts in the States and us in Europe, you know. Which was true for a very short period of time. You know, we always thought, I mean, it goes right back to when we looked at King's Quest and stuff. We thought those American games were a bit too slapstick for us. We wanted to do something a little bit darker. You know, so if you look at like Steel Sky, I mean, it's quite the backdrop to the game is quite dark and serious, you know, and the humor is a more immediate level. So, you know, it's full. I mean, those games all our games are full of humor, but it's not, we're not selling a humorous game, if you see what I mean. You know, we're selling the backdrop to Broken Sword is quite a serious, it's quite a serious plot and story. And you know, what's happening is like, you know, properly the end of the world is coming, you know, from the Templars, but a lot of funny things happen. And that was more our British take on the way to frame the game, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think so. I was a huge 2000 AD fan, and obviously Dave Gibbons was like involved with 2000 AD as well, and it had that kind of humor. I remember there was a robot that used to follow Dredd around and annoy him called Walter the Wobot, and he had a lisp, and it kind of reminded me of Joey from Beneath the Steel Sky.
Yeah, very like Joey in Beneath the Steel Sky. Yeah,
we love Joey.
I was wondering, was that a huge task kind of Beneath the Steel Sky, especially the implementation of audio?
Yeah, I mean, Steel Sky was probably the hardest one we ever did, actually, because it was a lot bigger than Lure of the Temptress, but we never had a budget that matched the scale of what we were doing. You know, so the thing was written really, really tightly on an absolute shoestring. I mean, it was a very close run was Steel Sky. You know, we could have gone down. I mean, Lure was dodgy in its own way because you know, we got caught up in the middle of the Mirosoft scandal. So we which actually in the end turned out well for us. But you know, Lure was difficult in its own way. Steel Sky was difficult because it was much bigger and there was just not the budget to match it. You know, what we turned out was a pretty great game. And after that, we had a huge opportunity because, you know, Steel Sky did well and people liked it. And Virgin kind of looked at it and said, what would happen if we actually funded you properly? And that was how Broken Sword came about.
what was kind of your relationship with Virgin? How did that get started? And
well, it all goes back to Charles knowing Sean Brennan. So when he was, and that goes back into the, it's a very convoluted, but Charles and Sean Brennan go right back into the Arctic days. And when Charles was at Activision, where he went after US Gold, he came across Sean Brennan again. And Sean said, look, if you ever go back into development, come and talk to me, which is obviously what eventually happened. When Sean was at Mirrorsoft. Now, Mirrorsoft went down with Robert Maxwell. Sean went across to Virgin. You know, Virgin in the early days of Virgin Interactive, they were really very cool. You know, they were kind of super ambitious, and you know, they'd throw a lot of money at promotion, and you know, the stuff they did with the Bitmap Brothers, sort of all the rock star photography shots and stuff. You know, they were trying to shake things up, and they were pretty bullish about things, and you know, their attitude to us was, well, you know, Steel Sky was pretty good. We'll fund you properly now. Do something. Do the best adventure game ever, and we'll see what happens. You know. So for that period of time, they were absolutely brilliant. Now, things later changed when the ownership of Virgin changed in America, and then the American office started to fail, and in a very familiar turn of events, you know, took its more successful European arm down with it.
Well, I loved Beneath a Steel Sky, and I remember first playing a demo of that on the cover disc of Amiga Format. I think it was during the school holidays, and just, you know, playing it over and over again, and couldn't wait for the full game to come out.
Yeah.
And it kind of felt around that time in, you know, 94, I remember, you know, Core Design released Universe that year as well. And obviously you guys put out Beneath a Steel Sky. It kind of felt like the British adventure game scene was really taking off. Tell us a bit about kind of the background of Beneath a Steel Sky from your memory then. And obviously, like Ravi mentioned, you know, Dave Gibbons being involved as well. How did the team and kind of the project come together and the idea?
Basically, we had this idea of cities in Australia, and I don't know how it came about, but we kind of had cities, and we had warring cities in the outback of Australia that they're all and a big sort of void between them all, and they all hate each other, and they're all sending AI to undermine the other one, and that's what we had, and we couldn't quite bring it into focus and sort of say this is what the game is. So Charles sent myself and Dave Cummins, who wrote a lot of the dialogue in those days, and was absolute genius at it. I mean, a lot of the humor came from Dave. So the two of us got sent to Wales again, and told not to come back until we had a coherent game design. So we drove up to Wales, messed about for like 3 or 4 days, and then we suddenly realized we only had a day left, and we had to go back with a design document for Charles. So we kind of just sat down and blitzed out a design of what would happen from start to beginning in Beneath a Steel Sky. And I was basically writing it on paper and handing the sheets to Dave, who typed them into the Mac. And we did this for like 8 hours solid. And at the end of it, we had basically a pretty good design document for Beneath a Steel Sky. And then it was safe to go back. So we got in the car the next day and took it back to Charles. And like probably quite a lot of that original design that it's just like an out-of-body experience, just like, shit, we have to type something, you know, so type. And what we came up with was not bad, actually. So a lot of it survived, and a lot of the characters came through. And I, amazingly enough, I actually found the handwritten notes that I did for that back in 93. I've still got them. So I'm gonna scan those and put them in the book. And anyone that can read my handwriting can check it against the eventual game. But I'm
amazing.
There's quite a lot of it that actually survived. So, you know, I was quite pleased about that.
It's really interesting, because it was at a period of time when kind of floppy disk technology was still being used, but CD-ROM seemed to come in favor. I think it came on 15 discs originally.
It came on, yeah, Amiga one. It came on. It was more like 14 discs, but yeah, there's a funny story where we actually, during development, we forgot about disc 13. So the game came on discs like 1 to 12, and then it skipped from 12 to 14 and 15. You know, and as you play it, it asks you to please insert disc 14 or whatever. And we suddenly realized there's a disk missing. So we didn't want to change the program at all. So it's sort of like the data moved down in all the tables and stuff. So all we did was change the text message and that it pops up. So when it says, when it should be saying, please insert disk 14, we changed it so it said, please insert 13. And then we just renumbered the disks. So there's actually a missing disk. I think it's 1 to 14.
I was wondering, did that help prevent piracy? Because the pirates wouldn't copy 15 disks.
Well, no, not at all, because we actually got a Russian pirate version of it that actually reorganized it all onto about 12 disks. So put some better compression in than we were doing. So no, it didn't help at all.
Well, I know you did actually do a CD-ROM talkie version. I mean, I was playing the CD32 version of it probably last summer, actually.
Right.
With the voice acting on as well. You know, that was very revolutionary for the time. I mean, some of the accents in there do crack me up a little bit.
I think it was the Royal Shakespeare Company that doing some of the voices.
What was the story there with that version then?
Well, we were running out of money basically on the normal version. So Virgin said, oh, here's what we can do. There's this thing called CD32 coming out. Why don't we do a voiced version for that? And here's the money that will take, you know, here's some extra budget for that version. So why don't we give you that money now to finish the floppy version? And then when that's finished, you'll get the completion bonus and you can spend the completion bonus on the CD32 version. So it was like an accounting sleight of hand. I mean, why they couldn't just give us some more money, I don't know, but that's what they did. So they said, basically, you're not going to finish this game. Or we said, we're running out of money. You know, we can't finish this. So the CD32 sleight of hand was how the game got finished, and then it turned out to be fairly. And I think it was one of the first ever voiced games, and it was pretty expensive as well because there was so much text in it. You know, it wasn't like a shoot 'em up where someone says game over or whatever, or get ready for level two. There was however many thousand lines of dialogue in it. So it turned out to be quite an expensive undertaking. The recording itself was in someone's front room on a busy road in London. It was a disaster because every time that the bus went past or a lorry, you could actually hear it on the first recording. So they had to send it. The whole thing got sent back and re-recorded again. So it was a complete shambles, a disaster really. But no one had ever done it before. I mean, we'd never been in a recording studio or knew what was the way to do it or how to organise such a thing, you know. So it was a total farce. Somehow we got away with it.
And I think as well, the fact that, you know, you actually had actors doing it, because I know a lot of times back then, you know, even like full motion video games, they'd often just get, you know, staff from around the office or the programmers to play the parts, wouldn't they?
Programmer voices. Yeah, that would have been a lot even worse. That would have been really bad. It's not bad actually, is it, the final one? I mean, the voices aren't bad at all. Apparently Jason Isaacs is one of the actors,
right?
Because he's, if you look on Internet Movie Database, if you find Jason Isaacs, who's obviously a big star now, you scroll down to the very bottom of his credited titles, you'll see Benny for Steel Sky there. And someone pointed this out to me and I was like, surely not. Went and had a look and saw it, and I was like, wow, I didn't know that. So I wrote to him on Instagram saying, hey, Jason, you don't know me, but apparently you starred in our video game back in the early 90s. Do you remember it? But he hasn't replied.
I was wondering, you know, that kind of CD-ROM, did that open your guys' eyes to, like, you know, creating Broken Sword and then a much bigger experience? But also, like, was there any Beneath a Steel Sky 2 stuff that happened? Was it ever considered?
Certainly CD-ROM, yeah. I mean, that once you see it, you know, once you get your, like hard disks and floppy disks, you know, once you see that technology, you realize that everything's going to shift very rapidly. So, I mean, Broken Sword was always going to be a CD-ROM game or a two CD-ROM game, as it turned out. As to what we did next, I think long before Steel Sky was finished, Charles and Sean were talking about the Templars, and I think they just got chatting over dinner one night about Templar stuff, and Charles got interested in it, and because I think Sean had read the Umberto Eco book, And I think that other book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, was starting to be a thing back then. So all of those things happened at once, and Templars was where we were going to go. And at that point, we just forgot about Steel Sky, you know, because it was so eclipsed by what Broken Sword was and what Broken Sword became. It was many years later before we started thinking, you know, this is something we should go back to because we actually own the rights to it, you know. We always started with a new engine, really. I mean, the script system would come across, and that was about it. I mean, and that system got improved quite considerably for Broken Sword. The rest of it was new, and it was also Broken Sword. We, you know, I sat down at the beginning of it and said, "What about all the virtual theater stuff? You know, are you gonna have this open world?" And you know, Charles kind of looked a bit sheepish and said, "It's time to give up on that stuff." And at that point, our engine became effectively the same as what LucasArts or Sierra had. You know, a single location, a UI and scripts and stuff. And it was actually a simpler engine than the previous ones. You know, Steel Sky's engine is more technically sophisticated in some ways than Broken Sword's because it has to do more.
And do you think we'll ever see, or is there a kind of a there's a Scum VM which kind of runs it in a virtual machine, Scum engine, and there's Residual as well, I think, for LucasArts Interpreter. Do you think we'll see a virtual theater one?
I think Scum VM can run all those anyway, can't
it? It does do,
Revolution
yeah.
Games. Oh, it does. Yeah. My knowledge of Scum isn't as good then, yeah. What do you think of people then playing these kind of older titles on modern systems and still yearning for them?
Well, I mean, it's a great, great thing. I remember when Scum VM wrote to us and said, "Can we have your source code?" You know, and in those days, you tended to be, I mean, as now really, you tended to be quite protective of things like source code. So it was quite a big ask in a way. I couldn't see any reason not to give them the source code and keep the games alive, because this would have been Broken Sword era when they wrote to us, and I kind of saw it as a way of bringing Steel Sky back to life, because I still sort of had the idea that in future that it would be cool to do a sequel. You know, I mean, everyone else had forgotten about it, and they were like, Broken Sword is the thing, you know, and of course it was. But I wanted to do a Steel Sky sequel, so I saw Scum VM as a way of bringing the game back to life and keeping it alive, and I couldn't see a downside given it wasn't really being sold anymore. So I actually got buy-in at Revolution and sent them the source code, and they ported it over, and we always did end up giving them the source code. So I mean, they've got Broken Sword games. I think they have In Cold Blood. I'm not sure. They might have In Cold Blood as well. But yeah, Scum VM is a great, great project. We always supported them.
It's really interesting, kind of, the way that you say that. I can see how you guys kind of, with the success of Broken Sword and all the other kind of adventure games disappearing with the rise of 3D, I can see how that was kind of seen as a huge direction for the company to go, and we're just going to cut and run and kind of go into that. Did you feel very proud and like a lot of success that the Broken Sword series was able to go onto these new platforms where other people hadn't been able to?
Yeah, I mean, and Broken Sword, I mean, it was bigger than anyone expected, really. You know, I mean, we had a feeling it was something quite good, but you never know until those first reviews start coming in. And it's still, Broken Sword is still a thing today. You know, you can go on the Facebook group and there's people chatting about it. You know, it was much bigger than anyone thought it would be, because when we were finishing Broken Sword 1, Virgin, who were at that point going the wrong direction, you know, their new people there were telling us that adventures were dead and, you know, forget all about it. And we're never going to make our money back on Broken Sword 1. So, you know, do a really cut down sequel, please. And you know, we might recoup. You know, they were quite unpleasant about Broken Sword even before it came out, and of course now it's seen as a classic game, you know. But we never thought back then that it would come back on GBA and iPhone and iPad and, you know, all the places where it's available now. We never in a million years thought that sort of thing would happen, you know. You know, you put it out on the PC and the Amiga, and 6 months later, its retail life is over, and that'll be the end of it. You know, that's what we expected.
Yeah, I heard it. Well, Charles told us in his interview that basically it was really hard to get any kind of promotion for Broken Sword, and without getting it on a few demo CDs and a few demo discs for the PlayStation, it wasn't driven commercially, whereas the users and the gamers actually really enjoyed it and pushed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those games that people like, and you know, word of mouth keeps it alive. So it was never like, you know, the publisher at the time, they were obsessed with Resident Evil, which, you know, it obviously sold a lot more at full price, and they were just, everything was Resident Evil. They were just crazy for it. And they were looking at Broken Sword and saying, this is just not as cool, you know, it's just not as cool. Can you do something like that? You know, we want action and blood and, you know, what's all this intellectual Templar stuff? It's too much, you know.
It's too smart.
it wasn't rock and roll enough for them, you know, by the end. But, you know, a lot of these people that were very rude to us back in those days, a lot of them go around now saying, oh yes, I was involved with Broken Sword. You know, that's one of my early works. You know, I guided that product and saw it through, you know. It's quite funny, really.
Rewriting history.
Yeah, history's always been rewritten. There's a lot of that around the Broken Sword and who worked on it and who did what and all the rest of it.
You mentioned before about, you know, having these ideas for a sequel to Beneath a Steel Sky, and obviously we got Beyond a Steel Sky in 2020. I mean, were you involved in that project then?
I was involved in early design and then not beyond that, so not the production.
Okay. Yeah. Where did the idea for that come from then, getting that back, that franchise back after all that time?
Well, I mean, the thing was, we owned the rights to it, which was actually quite something, because the publishing industry, what they were about was taking your intellectual property rights away from you in return for funding, you know. So not many people from the early days ended up owning their own stuff, but we did own both Broken Sword and Steel Sky. So I guess after Broken Sword 5, the feeling was, you know, we could, you know, the logical, it was either another Broken Sword, and people, you know, if you've just done 4 years, as it effectively was, on Broken Sword 5, it's like, can we do something else, you know? So it seemed like at the time was right to have another look at Steel Sky, because, you know, people were talking about it again. It was never quite as widely known as Broken Sword was, but I think people were coming to it, and you know, the ScumVM version and the fact that if you were a player of Broken Sword, you know, you might say, what else can I play? And people would say, you know, have a look at Steel Sky. It's not as good, but it's still pretty cool. So, I mean, it never died, you know, and it started to get its own little niche as a cult classic. And we figured there was a bit of interest, and it could be something that we'd be able to bring back to life.
Well, I know you do. You've run a blog on Tumblr all about your Revolution development day. So I'll link that up in the show notes as well. But obviously, you're turning this into a full, more fully fledged project. You're actually going to be doing a book about these tales, aren't you?
Yeah, well, it's just about finished. I mean, all this stuff, the reason I can speak about it with some confidence is that I've spent the last 6 months researching it and building a timeline of what happened when and you know, who did what and all the rest of it. I just figured that it was time to do it, because, you know, you go back to, you know, 1990, and it's quite a long time ago now, and people are starting to forget it, you know. Some people are actually dead, so, you know, if you wait too long, no one will remember it at all. So I thought it was important to try and get some of it down on paper and freeze that record, you know. So I've done a lot of research and talked to a lot of people and jogged people's memories and badgered them for documents and stuff, and I've actually got quite a good recollection now of what happened and how we made those games, and I put it all down. So yeah, that's coming in a month or so, hopefully.
So if people want to keep up to date with that, where should they go then? Is there anywhere they can keep an eye on?
Well, I mean, when it hits Kickstarter or however I do it, obviously Twitter is a good place. I'm on there, or there's tonywarrener.io. I think I have a mailing list on there as well. and a Discord channel. So any of those things, and keep an eye out, and I'll start talking about it more soon. It should be pretty good, because there's going to be, I mean, there's about 300 pages of text, which is bigger than I thought it was going to be. But I'm going to put in probably 100 pictures of different stuff. So it's going to be a real good thing for Revolution fans, certainly, and anyone with an interest in retro, anything retro game dev, you know.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's just important to get this stuff out there, because it's still, you know, it's such a young industry, relatively, isn't it? And I think a lot of the time, because it moves forward so quickly, that's one of the reasons that we do this podcast. I think, you know, often people forget to look back a bit, and you don't want this stuff to be lost forever, do you?
Yeah, and I think it's also people are interested in it now. You know, if you went back to, I don't know, you went back to 2010. I mean, some people are interested in it, but not as much. I think the whole retro gaming and you know, going back into 8-bit, there seems to be much more serious interest in it now than there used to be. You can write an Amiga game now and actually do okay from it, you know, or a Spectrum game. I mean, it's almost a commercial reality again. It's so great as the interest in that kind of era. So I mean, it just feels like a good time to do all this stuff, because it's not a thing to be forgotten and moved on from. You know, it's of value, I think.
And long may it continue. So yeah. I'll put a link to your website in our show notes as well, Tony, so people can keep an eye on that. And obviously, we'll give it a mention on the show when the Kickstarter launches too.
Awesome. Well, I'll send you a pre-production copy and you can have a read.
Really appreciate that. Thank you so much. And it's been incredible to talk to you as well and hear some of your stories. So thanks for taking the time to come on and be our guest this week.
That was great. Thank you very much.